This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. We're here every week to talk about subjects that we think are relevant and important and sometimes crucial and definitely topical, which is, of course, what we're talking about today. There's probably only two topical subjects in the world right now. And one is, of course, COVID, which we have mentioned and talked about with various guests many times in the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure we will continue to. And number two, of course, I don't know if this is the right order, but number two is the election. That just transpired, and that seems to be still going on, I guess, in some cases. And we are so fortunate today on Target because we have in the studio talking to us Dr. Peter Iacobucci, and he is an associate professor of political science and public law and the coordinator of the American Democracy Project and coordinator of the Conflict Analysis and Resolution Program. I'm really stuck on that one. I'll have to ask you, even though we've talked many times. And all of this is at SUNY Buff State, and we are talking through Zoom, and we have had an opportunity to talk to Peter before, so we know how knowledgeable he is. And But I guess I don't know what the coordinator, even though we've talked before, what is the Conflict Analysis and Resolution Program?
So approximately 4 years ago, I was approached by the provost of Buffalo State to talk a little bit about how our curriculum has changed. And one of the things I addressed is that we are changing our curriculum across the campus from a knowledge-based curriculum. Here's what happened, to a skills-based curriculum. Here's the skills you need to process information. Information is easy to come by now. We have Google and systems like that. It's what to do with it. And one of the things that I stress that we need to work more on and teach more on is the ability of individuals to negotiate and to figure out how to get out of conflicts, how to increase productivity by removing conflict in whether it's a work situation, a personal situation, a political situation. And that developed into a cross-campus, multi-department effort to develop a program at the graduate level of how do we train individuals to go into a business or who are currently at a business or an institution and teach them how to resolve conflicts successfully so that those conflicts don't hold people back. That's the development of the program. We're admitting students right now. We will be opening up for our first classes start fall of 2021. We're very excited.
Oh, this is really current that I'm talking about this. This could be a whole program. But I have to ask you, have they called you yet to go to the White House and to Washington to teach this conflict? This would be perfect. They need you, right?
Yeah. Well,
they need this.
It's not just national politics. We see it in local politics. We see it in everything. Any work environment you've been in, there have been intractable conflicts between individuals or between, you know, different parts of a corporation or an institution that really hold people back. And so the idea behind this is there's a relatively new science on how to get out of conflicts. What's the best way to solve conflicts where all parties involved are satisfied with the result and you can move forward successfully?
This, you're absolutely right, and this is, everybody needs to learn this in every aspect of life, no matter whether you're working for a small company or any profession, any job, and actually in life, you know?
That's really important
to resolve conflict. Well, what big conflict are we going to resolve now between you and I on the phone? The first one we're going to on Target, I should say, on the radio, but on the phone. Tell me what we're going to do, how we're going to resolve what's happening with the presidential election now.
Well, we're in the post-election period, which in almost every other year, this was the time that everybody forgot about the election. They're glad they don't have to see any more campaign commercials, and we can at least have a few weeks before the next campaign cycle starts. Not the case this year. This year, we're seeing a battle over the presidency in which Joe Biden has won a majority of the electoral votes, enough to win the presidency. But the current president, President Trump, the loser of the election, not willing to concede and fighting tooth or nail legally in many states to prevent Joe Biden from actually winning the Electoral College vote.
Now, this is totally unique. Or wait, let me start again. Is this totally unique? Has this ever happened in history?
It's certainly unique in modern times. We haven't had anything like this in modern times. There were some contested elections very early on in our country's history, and then there were a few post-Civil War. But nothing to the extent, at least the legal fight we're seeing, to the extent we're seeing right now.
So how? What are some of the legal issues? What are they trying? We keep hearing, okay, the president is claiming, they'll say, the media says, claiming without basis, without fact, or something like this, fraud, or something, you know, illegal, but without proof. What are the claims against the election?
So I like to think of it, there's two different campaigns going on. There's a media campaign of what you see on television, what you hear on the radio or see through social media, and then there's also a legal fight going on. The media campaign is to sow delegitimacy into the election process, into our election apparatus, so that enough individuals will accept the viewpoint that this election was a fraud, this election wasn't properly conducted, that the results of this election are in doubt. On the legal side, there has been a shift. For the first approximate week after the election, Trump's legal team aggressively sought out examples of electoral fraud, not just, miscapping a number on a piece of paper, but actual attempts to subvert the will of the people in the electoral process. They have found none. They have been unsuccessful in finding that and digging through all the swing states. So now that the next change that has happened in the last few days is to delay the state certification of their vote totals. And if they can delay those long enough, the hope is they will hit the deadline, which is December 8th, for all votes to be certified. If Joe Biden is not certified to receive a majority of electoral votes come December 8th, they're going to push that then the vote should be moved to the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives then would elect the next president. And the way it works in the House of Representatives, each state would vote separately, and the Republicans control more state caucuses in the House of Representatives, even though the Democrats control the majority of seats, and they would presumably then pick the Republican candidate, President Trump. That seems to be the legal focus now.
That seems very, very unique, to say the least. And also, sort of like our football team, sort of a Hail Mary type approach.
You have to bring up the Hail Mary pass. It some people are calling it, this is an attempted coup to steal an election. It's pretty clear that as we've seen votes come in, and as we've seen votes checked and audits conducted, Joe Biden won the majority of the votes cast. And not only that, more importantly, won enough states with enough electors attached to them to receive the majority of the Electoral College. And that should make him president. This is an ugly effort to steal an election by the current president of the United States.
You do hear claims, though, about fraud in the sense of dead, quote-unquote, dead people voting twice, that kind of thing. And we have heard, and not that the media is going along with this at all, of course, but you have heard claims of that. Do you think it's viable or it's going to be, can be proven?
Well, the two separate campaigns going on here, the media campaign and legal campaign. What can be said in the media, you can say anything you want in the media. In a legal campaign, if a lawyer is putting forth an argument that has false information before, they can be sanctioned, of course, by the court. That's against their oath as a lawyer, as of course, Judge Wolfgang, you would know.
I do.
Lawyers have not done that. They have not taken that step. They have, in documents presented to the court, suggested that might be happening, but no evidence has been provided yet of actual electoral fraud in this election. And it is quite remarkable, considering how the election was conducted. Look, we conducted this election like no election we've ever had before, that over 100 million people voted early. And the administration of this election is a remarkable success of how well it was done and how securely it was done.
Well, this is one of the questions I was just about to ask you. Is a lot of this the only reason, in a sense, that they have these claims is because it was such a unique election, or that these claims can have any validity legally or any other way, is because we've never seen, as you pointed out, anything like this where not only the early voting, but the mail-in voting.
That's right. And I think that is enough to begin to see doubt in people's minds of the security of the ballot and whether or not there could possibly be fraud. And we've all, every election, there are some accusations of electoral fraud, dead people voting multiple times, votes being discarded or double counted depending on which candidate was preferred. But as far as I can read, and I've checked every legal case that I can find so far, there hasn't been a single incident of significant voter fraud that would have any impact on turning the electoral result in any state so far put forth in a legal document.
So that's really, I mean, that settles that, really. But as far as what's going to happen in the future goes, what do you think would happen, or has it ever happened, that the president does not concede the election? And also, does it matter if he concedes the election?
Well, technically, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If the states certify their ballots as the way we believe that the states have the outcome is, Joe Biden will be elected the next president, and come noon on January 20th, he will take the presidency. And, I don't think you're going to see a scene where Donald Trump's being pulled out of the Oval Office on January 20th. But aside from the technical side of it, it does have an impact. The government is a $3 trillion organization, and there needs to be a transition from one president to the next president to make sure that is run smoothly. Right now, President Trump, from what we are told, is holding up any meetings between transition teams, between his current administration and Joe Biden's incoming administration. And that means that Joe Biden and his administration are put at a significant disadvantage come January 20th when they take office.
I said I wasn't going to talk about this for the millionth time, but I can't avoid it, and we can't avoid it. How is this going to affect our COVID? You know, what's going on in the country now with the COVID actually, accelerating instead of going away, and the distribution of the vaccine. Is this all going to be affected by this?
Well, that we don't know. At least at this point, we can say it doesn't appear that it's being affected yet. We have very good news coming out of the drug trials this week and last week that several different drugs seem to be very effective at preventing the spread of the pandemic of COVID-19. That's very positive. The next step becomes, okay, setting up the apparatus to distribute that vaccine to over 300 million U.S. citizens, and then having those citizens be willing to take the vaccine. And that we haven't got to, and we don't know yet how that apparatus is going to work, who's going to be in charge of it, how it's going to be pulled out. And I think that's probably going to wait until at least February or March when Joe Biden does become the president. And we'll see. But this unwillingness to move on, to have a peaceful transition between President Trump and President Biden could delay the distribution of that vaccine.
Which would be a tragedy, of course, for everybody in the country. Also, another effect that people are talking about this lack of transition and cooperation, might have to do with our security as a country. Do you see any relationship between the lack of cooperation in the transition and our, security?
Well, I know there was a letter written last week, or maybe it was early this week, the days all begin to run together, of over 100 former national security experts, high-ranking officials, both from Republican, both the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and even some from within the Trump administration that now have left his administration, that really worry about the threat to national security with this lack of transition. I don't know enough about foreign policy and to be able to say that there certainly will be a problem. But again, with anything, that the inability to plan, the inability to get ready, is going to make it difficult. And if I could use an analogy, it's like you were told on November 30th you had to move out of your house, but you were not allowed to pack a single thing until December 1st. You're not going to be ready to move. Like, that's right. The problem that we're running into.
Right. I just want to interrupt for a moment in case you just tuned in. You're listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. We hope you do listen to us every week. And today we are talking to Dr. Peter Iacobucci, who is an associate professor of political science and public law, and has a lot of other titles at SUNY Buffalo State. And I'm not going to get into that again and mess it up, right? Like I did before. Let's talk a little bit about the rest of, Congress, the rest of the results of the election, besides the president. Let's talk about Congress, about the two branches and how the election affected them.
Well, I think many of us are tired of our politics. We've had politics placed right in our face now for months and months, if not for years, since President Trump took office. And I think a lot of us are tired, and a lot of us really hoped, whether it would be Biden wins or Trump wins, whether the Democrats win in Congress or the Republicans win in Congress, but there would be a clear decision made that one party clearly would have ascended over the other party. That didn't happen. That certainly didn't happen in Congress. We have a Congress that is gridlocked, or more gridlocked possibly than it even was prior to this election. The Democrats retain the majority in the House of Representatives, but their number of seat majority has declined significantly, meaning it's much closer. In the Senate, the Republicans cling to a majority within the Senate, but we're waiting to see what happens in the two runoff elections in Georgia. If the Democrats can win both the runoff elections in Georgia, the Senate will be a perfect 50-50 split. And assuming Joe Biden becomes president, then Kamala Harris, our vice president, would break that split. That indicates to me our country is deeply divided. If we look at the data, President Trump, even though he lost the majority of votes in this election, even though he lost the number of electoral votes in this election, still won 20 states by over 10%. And as political scientists, a win by over 10% is normally considered a landslide. Of those 20, 17 he won by more than 15%. We are a very, very divided country with red states and blue states, a few swing states in the middle. And what's most nervous to me, what makes me most nervous, is within those blue states, within those red states, certainly you see this in New York, you're beginning to see more and more single-party dominance. In New York, the Democrats control the state government apparatus. If you were to go to a red state like Oklahoma, the Republicans control the state apparatus. That is not healthy for democracy. Democracy succeeds when there's open competition. When one party dominates, whether it's Democrat, whether it's Republican, or even some other party, if that was possible, that usually results in corruption and bad government performance.
And people are saying, however, that we can look forward, like you said, it would be nice if everything was over, but we can look ahead to 2 years from now, that usually in the off-presidential year, things change back, everything changes back, and we get more of a two-party system. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm asking?
Yes, right. The president's party normally loses seats in Congress in a midterm election. A couple things about that. One, the Republicans are defending some very closely contested seats in the Senate come up in 2 years. This should be a tough election for Republicans come 2022. So that shift back towards the Republicans might not be as pronounced. And the other problem is what just comes off. There are so many seats within the House of Representatives that have been gerrymandered. So either the Republican is going to win or the Democrat is going to win. It's not really a contested seat. It's a given who is going to win that seat. And so the swings that we see in partisan balance within Congress continue to get smaller and smaller as fewer and fewer seats are actually competitive.
taking a step back when you said something about how don't forget that Trump actually got anything like you consider like 10% or something is considered a lot. Look at the what it was like when before the election, when the polls were saying it was going to be a Democratic landslide, quote unquote, and all the figures were so overwhelming. That didn't happen that way.
I think that's right. I mean, look, this is two national presidential elections where the polls were wrong. And in this case, it appears that polling, there's two problems going on with polling. They're underestimating conservative voters and their ties to the Republican Party. That is clear. And the other problem is the turnout models that we have, who is going to vote and who isn't going to vote. We're clearly off this time around. We knew there would be a large turnout. We didn't know it would be this large a turnout. This is the highest number of individuals to vote for, or a percentage of individuals of eligible voters to vote for the presidency since the election of 1900, so that's 120 years ago, and 165 million Americans voted. We've never anywhere approached that number, and the model simply just didn't account for that.
So it's not like this probably could ever happen again. I mean, it might be unique between because of the candidates, because of COVID, because of the situation, all of the social issues. I think it might be. Don't you? It might be a unique situation that could not be repeated.
I wouldn't say not be repeated, but I would say that, look, you had a this is unique times. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We're in an economy that is in desperate trouble right now because individuals can't work because of the pandemic. You have the most toxic candidate that we've ever had in President Trump. Either people loved President Trump or they hated President Trump. There were very few people in the middle. We haven't had a candidate quite to that extent before. Could it happen again? Sure, those conditions could happen again, but I wouldn't expect them to happen again. I would expect in 4 years from now, assuming Joe Biden is running for re-election, or if not, Kamala Harris might be the nominee. I don't think, unless the Republicans nominate Donald Trump again, which is a possibility, I think the turnout will probably go down in 2024.
Has anybody heard you say that? I could hear the groaning at the other end of the people listening. Now, I asked you this before. Everybody is always saying to me, and probably to you, why can't we have an election? Why can't we have election day like we've had forever and ever, where people just go on election day and go to the polls and vote in person? And if they can't, they get an absentee ballot. And there's one day called election day. And that's how it always was, as far as I can remember back, right? Why can't we have that again? And will we have that again?
Well, we certainly could have that again, but if I'm a Democratic elected official, under no circumstances would I want that to happen again. Democrats do well when turnout goes up. That pretty much is a maxim that people can bank on. And the way to get turnout to go up is make it as easy as possible to vote. So mail-in votes, early voting. Don't be surprised if there's going to be a push in the next few years for internet voting. We do everything else on the internet. Why can't we not vote on the internet? And Democrats would be in support of that. Now, on the other side, on areas and jurisdictions that are controlled by Republicans, it would be to their electoral advantage to bring it back to we all just vote in person on Electoral Day. That would reduce turnout, and that would likely benefit Republicans. But I think once people get used to it, it's going to be difficult to go back. And again, I can make an analogy. Why don't we all just go to stores and shop anymore? Well, that's because there's things like Amazon. And it's so much easier at 10 o'clock at night in my pajamas to just click the button on my computer and order it. And 2 days later, it shows up in my house than the old way we used to shop. And I think the old days of voting, of pulling the levers on the machine, which I loved, are not coming back. That we are forever going to have mail-in voting, and we will likely forever have early voting as well.
I wish I hadn't asked you this question because I don't like the answer. What that? one last thing is we didn't talk about the effect on local, on what you mentioned, like New York, for example, being totally Democratic in every office. Did the presidential election affect the down, what they call the down ballot in most states?
Oh, I think it certainly did. I think in areas where it was close, I think it pulled voters out. And the perfect example of that is the New York 27 race between Nate McMurray and Chris Jacobs. Those two have battled, and they did this summer. They had a special election this summer that was remarkably close. Donald Trump wasn't on the ballot this summer. Donald Trump was on the ballot in November, just a few weeks ago. And that pushed Chris Jacobs easily to a win. And once Donald Trump designated Chris Jacobs as his preferred candidate for the Republicans in that race, essentially it was over for Nate McMurray, no matter what campaign he ran. And so I think it did have an impact on those. To another extent, having Donald Trump on the ballot had a significant impact in urban areas across the country. It drove individuals to the candidates running against Donald Trump, whether it's Joe Biden at the top or any lower-level candidates that clearly staked their claim against President Trump and what President Trump stood for that helped them tremendously this last election.
So, again, this could be unique, or it could be a continuing situation. I guess we'll have to wait and see, right?
Right. I think the biggest thing going forward is what happens with Donald Trump. Look, as you said, it's a Hail Mary for Trump to still win this presidency. It really would be. And assuming that Hail Mary isn't caught by DeAndre Hopkins and the Bills lose. But let's say that doesn't happen. Instead, let's say Joe Biden becomes president. It's what happens with Donald Trump, because the Republican Party, certainly at the national level right now, is completely controlled by Donald Trump, completely. He has already indicated that those individuals within the party that in any way stray from the Trump orthodoxy, he will sponsor a primary candidate to run against them in the Republican primary. Donald Trump has power within the party. I don't think Donald Trump's going to be willing to give up that party. And I think it's going to take an outside event to remove him as a power factor in that party. And that could be the lawsuits that are likely to be filed against him come January.
This gives us something to talk about on our next show when we talk to again, Peter. And also, I said I wasn't going to, but look, I ended up with talking about the three things, the Hail Mary, which really upset us, the election, and COVID. I managed to do that all on target this time. I hope people aren't mad. I hope my listeners aren't mad at me. But thank you so much for being with us. And thanks, everybody, for listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang. I hope you will join us again next week, same time, same station. Have a really good and be safe week, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.